Chapter 13. Echidon. The vengeful spirit rode a sea of fire. Weapon discharge and muzzle flare hid its hull. Its void shield shattered under incoming fire, the inner layers regenerating as the outers snapped out of being. Around it rode its sisters of war, each ship holding close to its monarch, their batteries firing without cease. Around them their enemies spun, strobing cords of light linked foes, binding them together, slashing the dark to black tatters. The string of defense platforms hanging in the void pulsed fire from a distance, and beyond them the five-star fortresses waited for the battle to enter the volume between their guns. Each of them spun in place, crenellated pinwheels set amongst the stars. Their sub-bastions held enough firepower to match a ship of the line. Together, they could destroy a fleet. The outer fortress was already firing, batteries of cannons and torpedo racks loosing as they rotated into alignment. The vengeful spirit and her sisters plunged on into the cauldron of fire between the fortresses. To a mundane understanding, it would have seemed foolhardy, but it was a calculated act of aggression. As it came on, it dragged the warships with it, hugging them close in an embrace of point-blank weapon fire. From the outside, the target volume was a cauldron of radiation, plasma bloom, and debris. That made accurate fire difficult. The scattered ships of both sides were so close that they jumbled together in the reckoning of gunnery systems and targeting cogitators. The Sons of Horus plunged on, accelerating, mauling the ships that came to meet them, closing on the nearest fortress like a knife point forced down into flesh through struggling arms. Void battles could be conducted at hyper-range, in calculations and manoeuvres that played out like the ticking of clockwork. This was not a battle of that breed. This was a brawl. Every ship in the battlesphere was taking and giving fire. Hulls split, gas vented from wounds driven through meters of stone and metal. Fires roared into the blackness before choking off as they consumed the air that fueled them. Munitions detonated in flowers of nucleonic blue and fusion red. And every vessel torn apart as its reactor detonated, every impact of a breaching craft stabbing through adamantium plate, was a flash of silent colour in the mute dark of the night. The sounds filling the guts of the vengeful spirit came from within, not without. Echidon's ears vibrated with the pulse of guns and engines as he moved down the companionway. He had spent most of his life in the void, and much of that time on the Warmaster's flagship, and could read such sounds as though they were the vessel's voice. He heard that voice clearly now. The ship was at maximum damage output, its reactors running close to the danger margin, shields collapsing as fast as they were brought back online. But it was exultant, growling its defiance and pleasure at the lives its weapons took.
"Enemy have breached the hull, one deck down,"
said Kobarak, as they hurried through the pulsing alert light. Echidon glanced back at his honor squad's signals officer. Kobarak's red eyes returned his look from beneath the studded brow of his helm.
"Strength?"
"Estimated at 50, but they are 9th Legion. 17th Company are moving to counter."
Echidon felt the muscles in his jaw twitch.
"Oh, that'll be a fight," he said. "But not our fight."
Kobarak did not reply. Like the rest of his command squad, the signals specialist knew what they were committing to. Echidon had selected all 9 with care. They were all blooded warriors of the Cathartidae, and wore the coin of that brotherhood on a cord around their sword arms. All owed their place in the Reavers of the First Company to him, and all had killed Legion brothers. Ambition flowed in their blood almost as thickly as the genes of their sire. They were killers, who dreamed of being warlords, and they would follow Echidon on his path without hesitation. The corridor trembled again, and the sound of an explosion rose above the blare of sirens and the clang of their boots on the deck.
"Here,"
said Echidon, pausing and yanking up a wide hatch close to the floor. Flakes of rust and dust fell from its edges. The squad moved into position along the corridor walls, weapons covering both directions, pistols drawn. Echidon braced to drop through the hatch.
"Halt and identify!"
The call came down the passage behind them and over the vox. Six armored figures were moving down the corridor in loose battle order, the yellow alert light gleaming from the golden eyes of their pauldrons.
"Identify!"
came the challenge again. Ekadon recognized the voice. Hegron, lieutenant of the 17th Company, a capable, if straightforward, warrior.
"Stand down, Hegron," said Ekadon.
The other warriors halted, but did not lower their weapons, Ekadon noted.
"I was not informed of your presence in this area of the ship, Captain. Full battle condition is in place," said Hegron,
his head moving fractionally as his gaze shifted to the hatch that Ekadon had just pulled open.
"And this area of the ship is on special condition."
"First company business," said Ekadon.
The tunnel space about them was still, but for the quick flashes of the alert lights. Hegron and his squad had still not moved.
"Stand down, Lieutenant. You were not logged or linked into the local tactical vox," said Hegron flatly. "What are you doing here?"
Ekadon stepped away from the hatch, raising his hand placatingly.
"I cannot tell you, brother, but we do not have much time, so I hope that you will forgive."
Ekadon drew and fired his bolt pistol. The round that punched from the barrel had twice the explosive force of a standard bolt shell, and a shaped cap of ceramite around a metal tip. When it struck, the explosion turned the metal to liquid, and the sheath directed the blast and liquid forwards in a burning jet. They had not existed before the beginning of the war. They had not needed to. After all, what need for a round that had only one purpose? To kill armored space marines. The round struck Hegron on the raised lip of armor just below his neck. The detonation was a blink flash and roar of light. Hegron's head ripped from his body. He fell, arms thrashing, as the pressure wave slammed through his flesh. One of Hegron's squad opened fire.
"Fast," thought Ekadon. "Shame to waste such ability."
He half-ducked back as a bolt round burst on the mass of the open hatch beside him. He fired back as the rest of his command squad opened up. They had been ready. Hegron's squad had not. Sound roared through the corridor, rising to drown out the alert sirens for a second, then vanishing to leave only echoes. Ekadon's reavers moved forwards, and for a moment the sound of single gunshots returned as they put rounds through the left eye of each of Hegron's squad.
"Give them the coins," said Ekadon,
taking a circle of mirror-polished metal from a pouch on his waist and tossing it onto Hegron's gore-splattered chest. It was an old custom, older than the Legion, an honour given to the dead and a warning to the living from the murder-soaked tunnels of Chthonia.
"Captain," Kabarak hissed. "We should not do it,"
snarled Ekadon.
"This is a blood war now. The least we can do is observe the formalities."
He moved back to the hatch. There was a second door beyond the first, smaller and heavier, its frame and setting thick with rust bloom. He tried to open it just to be certain, but its lock had been fused long ago.
"Cut it," said Ekadon. "Fast!"
One of his warriors moved past him, a lascutter keening as it lit. Molten metal began to run down the door. Rust puffed to smoke. The beat of sirens filled his ears. His mouth was dry with adrenaline. The lascutter went out. The warrior stepped back, and Ekadon took hold of the release handle. He hesitated. He felt his breath hold in a dry mouth. He had not paused before killing Hegron, nor when the creature Tormageddon had come to him. But now he felt that he was about to do something that would have implications larger than anything he had done before. He was crossing a line. The future that waited beyond this door was one that he wondered if he would survive. He let out the breath and pulled. The hatch creaked, then came free. Droplets of cooling metal fell from it as it hinged wide. Air rushed into the space beyond, tugging at the hatch before he secured it. Somewhere a system screen would be blinking amber at a servitor, monitoring internal atmosphere pressure. Like the dead they left in the outside corridor, that did not matter. Beyond the hatch, the cold dark of the black levels marched away out of sight. He drew his power blade, thumb on the activation stud, and stepped through. Low temperature warnings lit in his helmet display. Nothing moved around him except dust and rust particles stirred up by the false wind. He had taken three steps when he felt instinct prickle the back of his neck. He whirled, blade lighting. An armoured figure stood in the dark beside him.
Captain,
rasped Malachurst, and Ekadon thought he could hear the twisted bastard smiling.
I almost thought he would not be coming.
Lyak, you need to return to the war, Fulgrim, said Lorgar. His voice was low, but rolled across the throng like a pressure wave. Some of the mutants knelt. Others twitched and vomited blood. A golden halo had unfolded from Lorgar's shoulders as his psychic force manifested in the warp-saturated air. Fulgrim squirmed, a hand running through Unkari's hair, while another picked a wet red fruit from a silver platter and held it out to the bloated demon. Alayak noticed that the exalted demon's face was a warped echo of Fulgrim's own, a fattened parody of the demon Primarch's soul-breaking perfection. Unkari ate the fruit and licked Fulgrim's fingers.
How long has it been, brother, since we talked? I mean, really talked. Swap stories and all those little conversational intimacies that are supposed to be the mark of fraternal bond. Too long.
He ran his tongue over his teeth. It was very pink.
Maybe. But then again, maybe not.
The war.
After all, we're not really brothers, are we? Any more than bacteria that spawn on the same rotten meat, our siblings. It is difficult to grow emotion in a test tube, though I doubt that our father tried that hard. The balance of family life was hardly the top priority.
Lorgar's face remained unmoved, his eyes unblinking. Lyak could feel the control washing off the Primarch as the halo glowed brighter around his head.
You have been blessed and exalted, Fulgrim, he said. Your nature is as the Dark Prince wills. I do not dispute that. But I am here to bring you back to the war you left incomplete.
Which war is this, brother dear?
Said Fulgrim, running a finger over Nkari's cheek.
I lose track. Time is not what it was.
The war against the Emperor. The war to take back the Imperium and give it to the gods.
Oh, yes, that war. I remember it. How did it end again?
It did not, said Lorgar, though his eyes had narrowed slightly, though the end is close. That is why I am here, to call you back to it.
For Horus, said Fulgrim,
watching Lorgar out of the side of his eyes as he licked the red fruit stains from his fingers.
This war was never just about Horus, said Lorgar. It is the victory of the primordial truth over our father's lies.
Lies. I was always rather fond of lies. But no matter, what you have come all this way to say is that I should come back to your pitiful age, gather the creatures that the Emperor tore from my loins, and what?
Fulgrim twitched a shrug, then continued in a voice that roiled and growled with false exultation.
I should stand shoulder to shoulder with my beloved brother Horus, fight the fight of righteousness, see your father cast down, weep the tears of a rejected but avenged son.
A murmur of laughter ran through the watching crowd of monsters.
That's your job, brother dear.
You are refusing, said Lorgar.
Refusing's too strong a word. The truth...
The demon Primarch smiled as he waited the word.
The truth is that I just don't care.
Now you are lying, said Lorgar.
No.
Fulgrim fixed his gaze on Lorgar's, the smile sinking back into coldness.
No, I am not.
Red malice bloomed in Fulgrim's slit pupils.
I am sure you don't intend every detail of this meeting to be pathetic, Lorgar, but somehow, even without that intention, you have succeeded. Horus would be so displeased.
Horus.
Lorgar said the name carefully, rolling the sound like a wave turning over a stone.
I am not here for Horus.
You said something almost like that before,
said Fulgrim, the sly grin hooking back into place.
And I thought...
There can't be high and true Aurelian flirting with treachery. But it wasn't just flirting, was it? Delight shone in the gleam of teeth behind his grin. Do tell me more.
Horus will fail, and then everything that we have done will be ashes. Mankind will not embrace the gods. The tyranny of our father's ignorance will continue.
You want me to help you betray him?
Oh, Lorga! I didn't think you had it in you.
Fulgrim uncoiled himself from Inkari and slithered down the side of the dais towards Lorgar.
And then what? Who will take his place? Oh!
Fulgrim chuckled.
Brother! Sweet brother mine! You mean to take the crown and sit on the throne, don't you?
You have become far less dull than I remember.
Priest, king of a realm where gods and mortals dwell in union, where ambition is righteousness, entropy sacred, excess embraced, and slaughter is devotion. I can see it! I can see it, brother! The cities of gold and bone, the worlds of ash. Oh, I can hear the screams and taste the pyre smoke.
Fulgrim closed his eyes and rolled his head back, nostrils flaring as he inhaled.
It is not for me. This is for the gods, for mankind.
Fulgrim swayed in place and then exhaled with a sigh. He lowered his head and opened his eyes. They were flawless, wet black.
He died on Davin, you know. He only lives by the power of the Four, he said. If the gods abandon him, he will be no more. The echo finally faded. The light that blazes in place of his soul, gone.
Fulgrim's smile flickered and thinned.
Like pulling the cables out of a machine.
Victory in this war is greater than any individual. It is worth anything and everything.
And you want me to... what? Return to Horus's side and then plunge the dagger in before following you to Terra?
The words still held an edge of mockery, but the tone was grave.
Not just that, Fulgrim, said Lorgar. You are at one with the divinity of the Dark Prince. You are the son of the false emperor and brother to Horus. Where you go, the tide of your god flows.
Flattering. Tempting. But as I said, I just don't care enough to join in.
His smile split wide across his face again.
You really are a fool. The Dark Prince does not withdraw his favour from Horus, and you think that you can lay low the War Master and then tame the forces loyal to him? Hubris is a delicious sin, but one that will undo you if taken to excess. Take it from me.
He will fall, said Lorgar.
He falls already. That is why this must be done, because he is too weak to see this crusade to its end.
And you think that the others will bend their knee to you?
They will bend their knee to the gods that own their souls, and the gods have brought me this insight so that I might do their bidding. They are all the gods' children, and the gods will this.
You are sure of that?
Lorgar's face twitched into a smile.
I have faith.
You will need more than that to persuade a child that this is anything but a joke without the grace of humour.
He turned and began to slither back to the dais.
I will enjoy watching what happens, though.
I'm sorry, Fulgrim, said Lorgar,
his voice calm, but the halo of power around him growing like a sun rising above the horizon.
That choice is not one that I can allow you to make.
The crowd shivered and hissed with fear and anger. Fulgrim was turning, the white mane of his hair rising in a sudden wind.
Your time is now, my son.
Lorgar's psychic sending slotted into Lyak's mind and turned it over like a key opening a lock. Lyak took a breath. Behind his eyes, thoughts began to whirl. Fragments of memory and sensation and words began to flow together.
He had said to Lorgar in his sanctuary on the Trisaion.
The exalted creature that is your brother, it may refuse.
It may, my son, his Primarch said.
That is why you are coming with me, and why I must ask your forgiveness again.
Forgiveness, Lord?
You need to bear a burden that I cannot. Fulgrim was still turning. Blades glinted in hands. Mouths opened in cries of delight and rage. A void opened in Lyak's mind. Words unfolded into blackness, spreading into strings of syllables that reached past language and into eternity. It was not language, not as mortals could speak it. It was a name. A single name, spoken by nightmares beyond the door of sleep. On and on it went, curling like a serpent. He felt his soul shriek, but the fragments of knowledge were bursting out from where they had been seeded inside him. Each of them was a part of the name, a slice of the worm that pushed up from the void and into his throat. The first syllable coughed into the air in a splatter of blood. The stones of the piazza shook. Fulgrim twisted as though struck. And now time was winding slowly as the syllables sliced through the instants. The crowd howled in rage. Lorgar's mace was in his hand, lit with lightning. His halo was flame. A pulse of telepathic command snapped out. The guns of the word-bearers came up, fingers on triggers. Actea was in Lorgar's shadow, blurred by psychic force. All of these things happened in the split second it took Fulgrim to rear up and turn. He grew as he moved, faster than a lightning strike, body swelling with anger. The sky flashed to black. Light became blinding. Lightning cloaked his muscle, freezing into plates of armor. Curved swords manifested in his fists as they rose. His eyes fastened on Lyak, burning with fury. Lyak could feel that gaze passing through his flesh and armor, stripping back the wards written on his skin and shivering through his body. The mask was glowing white hot against his face. He felt small, an insect flying into a thunderstorm. Fulgrim lashed forwards. The word-bearers opened fire. The crowd charged. Lorgar leapt to block the path of his demonic brother as Lyak felt another molten, writhing sound force its way onto his tongue, and the next syllable of Fulgrim's true name split the air. Argonis. Deluge sparkled with flames. Detonations spread under the black pall, clogging the atmosphere. Equatorial forests burned from the edge of night to the dawn terminator. Millions of sap-heavy trees poured smoke into the air. Above the planet's sphere, the ruin of its defences drifted in a belt of Nord wreckage. Warships hung low above the planet. Their guns were silent, their scarred hulls emptied onto the world beneath. Storm clouds boiled above the ruins of its cities. Dirty lightning sheeted the sky. Ash-clogged rain daubed the ruins grey. The fires of the death pits still burned, though, even under the wet lash. Argonis had looked down into the first pit they passed. A scum floated on the surface of the burning oil and fat. The domes and faces of a few skulls poked through the liquid and fire. The air above the pit shimmered. Patterns formed in the smoke. Faces, mouths, teeth. They had seen bodies in the cities, hacked apart and left where they had fallen. Only those that died with weapons in their hands went into the skull pits. He had seen similar before, though not on this scale. On Hastrix, the War Master's sworn forces had piled the bodies and heads of the slain under conical crusts of earth and cooked the meat off them. Raked from the ashes, the skulls had been hung from the crane gantries above the mines. It was ritual, a vile kind of honour to the enemy and an offering to the slaughterborn god of the warp. Pieces of armour, helmets and lasguns littered the lips of the pits, slathered with soot and blood. The gleam of frogging and the marks of uniform designations flashed from the muck. They had passed 10 cairns of skulls already, each as high as a tank. He understood what was happening here. He had listened to Malachurst enough to know why such things were done. He did not like it. It was not the slaughter that worried him. It was what it implied.
This is an accursed world now,
he said aloud.
They have made it so.
Perturabo said nothing, but looked out as the grey rain fell to meet the rising fires. The Iron Warriors stood on a hill that had been a building. Girders projected from the slope of rubble, chips of painted plaster still visible amongst the shattered brick. Thick rain pattered off the shells of their armour. A demi-grand company arrayed beside armour and the hulking forms of dreadnoughts. Vehicles and prefabricated fortifications ringed them, positioned and deployed in minutes once they had reached the hill from the landing site. That had been over 3 hours before. In that time, and in the 10 kilometres of flattened city they had crossed, they had seen no living thing.
"They're not coming," said Argonis.
The air tasted of copper even through his helm filters.
"They will," said Perturabo,
eyes fixed on the land lurking beyond the curtains of rain. They had seen the fires of battle from the edge of the system, sensor echoes of plasma and nuclear detonations across the spectrum. No one had challenged the Iron Blood or its sisters as they moved in system. There were no picket ships, no watches waiting for enemies or friends, just the smudges of heat from where defense platforms had exploded. The fleet had been within weapon range of the planet before the World Eater's ships had responded. There were a lot of them, 30 at least in visual range, and likely more on the other side of the planet. They had moved as though in a torpor, uncoordinated, their guns ready but their sensors half shut down. The largest of them bore a name that had held a reputation even before the Shadow Crusade had marked it with scars, and the warp had set a patina of crimson on its hull. The Conqueror looked like a ruined queen of destruction, her finery tattered, her beauty lost to scars. She was the equal to the Iron Blood in size, but war had not been kind to her. Still, she turned to meet the Iron Warriors like a slaughter-drunk warrior rising from her chair with sword ready. Perturabo's ships had stopped dead on the edge of the World Eater's weapon range. Their guns were lit, and they had painted every ship and angle with weapon plots. 10,000 Iron Warriors waited in their launch bays, their guns filled with ammunition, their lips silent as they awaited their lord's will.
"Send it," Perturabo had said.
And the signal had reached out to the Conqueror.
"This is the voice of Perturabo, Lord of the Fourth Legion. I come from Horus, War Master of the New Imperium, with a message of his will. We come as brothers in blood and war."
A reply had come, scratching with static from being bounced through atmosphere to a ship, and then from ship to ship.
"This is no place for you," it had said in a halting growl. "Leave us! Go!"
Then it had cut out, and no further word had come. The World Eater's ships had not tried to stop them as the Iron Blood and its sisters had moved into Deluge's orbit. They had stayed close, though, approaching within hundreds of meters of the Iron Warriors, their guns primed like wild dogs running beside a rival pack. The Iron Warriors had dropped in a single wave. 5,000 warriors, armor and materiel, roaring down through smoke and storm clouds to stand on a murdered world. Argonis had not asked why they went arrayed for battle. The answer was obvious. They might need to fight. On the surface, they had moved and deployed with a swift efficiency that Argonis had only just been able to follow. War machines had been positioned, defense lines erected, and munitions sighted, without Perturabo speaking a word. It was like watching the cogs of a machine turn.
"We are here to bring them to the War Master, not to slaughter them," Argonis had said.
Perturabo had looked at him for a long moment.
"Words will fail here," he said. "You can taste that truth in the rain. Battle is the only dialogue that my brother will hear."
Beneath the rain, Argonis shook his head and was about to speak again when a hiss and scrape of metal made him turn. The hunched shape of Volk stood behind Perturabo, standing almost as tall as the Primarch now. He was pointing into the distance with a hand of blades. Argonis looked in that direction. At first he saw nothing, and then his eyes found it, a shadow amidst the grey streaks and smoke. It walked closer, its movement slow but somehow awkward, as though it were forcing itself to move that slowly. Guns rose as the figure drew closer. It kept walking. Argonis could see it more clearly now. A lone warrior in plate and helm, caked in blood and ash. More guns rattled to alert and turned to cover the warrior. No one spoke. The figure began to climb the hill of rubble, then stopped just beneath the lowest palisade. He looked along the plasteel barrier, at the levelled guns of the warriors behind it, and then raised his gaze to Perturabo.
"Leave," he said. "You should not be here. Go now."
Argonis recognized him then. They had met before, fought once even, shared battle zones and command briefings, though he remembered the warrior's bearing as much as his voice. Still, he could not keep the question out of his own voice as he spoke.
"Khan?"
The warrior's gaze twitched to Argonis, but he did not reply. Rain slid in heavy trickles down the face of his helm. His armour was gore-caked and fire-blackened, the white and blue of its colours all but lost beneath red and black. He held his chain axe loose at his side, the flesh of his axe arm bare. Argonis saw the hand twitch on the haft. Chains rattled. He did not look like the warrior that Argonis had known. He looked like something much more fragile and much more dangerous. The World Eater shivered, then shook his head as though trying to clear it.
"Go,"
he said again, the words rasping with effort.
"We come with the War Master's will,"
called Argonis, the words loud but flat in the pattering rain.
"Where are your brothers? Where is your Lord Primarch?"
Khan shook his head once.
"Leave,"
he said. The chain axe in his hand gunned to life for an instant, shreds of meat scattered from the teeth.
"Your ships let us land," said Argonis. "We're here because the War Master calls you to play your part in the fall of the false Imperium. You are called to the Gates of Terror."
A slow breath hissed from Khan's speaker grill.
"Khan, listen to me," said Argonis. "Angron must—" "He is dying!"
roared Khan. The chain axe spun to life, and Argonis thought he could see the effort of will vibrate through Khan as he kept it still at his side. He was breathing hard, the sound rasping from his speaker grill.
"This is all that is keeping him here."
He jerked his head at the flames rising from the death pits.
"We did it for him. I did it for him."
The display of Argonis's helm began to ping with warnings fed from the Auspex systems of the Iron Warrior's tanks. There were things moving towards them behind the veil of rain and the wash of flame. Countless things moving fast.
"They will come,"
said Khan. Every word now seemed an effort.
"If you do not leave now, they will come."
Perturabo turned his head slightly and nodded. The iron circle closed around him, shields locking. Every weapon across the hillside armed with a buzz of charge and a clatter of cycling breeches. He looked back to Khan.
"Let them come," he said.
Behind Khan, the first of the World Eaters broke through the curtain of rain with a roar of fury.